Okay, so let's begin today's lecture in virtual machines. Last time we have finished with the procedural language, the CIMA, and this time we're going to tackle functional languages, PUF, and well, this is a functional high-level language, which means that we need a few adaptations to the virtual machine concepts that we've seen so far to really comfortably support the instructions that we're going to see popping out of the translation schemes for this subset of a functional language. So that's all what we are talking about here. So we really focus and concentrate on the functional properties of a language as its core properties, and gonna for now not talk about things like side effects, data structures, or things like exceptions. So we've already seen a sneak peek into this last time. We're going to talk about a language that has things like computations on basic values with variables. So you're going to see constants. As before, we see variable names being used. We see unary operators and binary operators. So far, nothing new. Then there's the if branch, which has now made its way into actual expressions instead of statements as it had been before. So in contrast to before, what we find behind this then and else is not statements anymore, but it's expressions. So these evaluate to some basic value at some point, and this they will constitute to the value of the whole if expression. So yeah, if you have this, if you remember this question mark operator in C-like languages, this is also an expression, a conditional expression. That's the thing that we find here too. Then there's usually the application of some functional thing that is returned by e prime to some arguments e0 to ek minus 1 in this case. So we're gonna see what that can be a little bit later on, but something to do with function application at least. Then there's the declaration of a function, so that's what you're gonna see in things like these. Then we can bind expressions to some name with this let expression and use it in the expression e0, which will then automatically become the return value or constitute the return value of that expression. And then there's recursive bindings in the sense that you can reuse the name that you're currently binding for the declaration of what you bind to that thing. Okay, so these are the basic things. As before, we will not bother with precision of data types or introduce any fancy other stuff than just ints. So basic types for our purposes will just be int. Everything else we consider to be just, well, extensions to what we have done so far. Typical programs look the way that you see here, where usually everything boils down to computing some value somewhere. And this would be this is for this thing, usually given by the expression after the in. And this will mean that some expression here is applied to some other expression. In this case, it's constant expressions. The that it's applied to, so it's applied to a 7, and what is applied is a name that's bound in the first part of the let expression. It's even used in a recursive manner, so you find this fact being referred to during the definition of what that means, and well, the value is a function, so functions can be values here. It's first class member of the values, and the thing itself looks like it has a parameter name to be used within, and then there's just an if expression that branches based on the parameter and then either returns value 1 or a value obtained from this multiplication, where we have another recursive use of, or well, the first recursive use of this fact thing, which will then just recurs on until we hit the base case, if you're lucky. So that's what a typical program might look like. These programs can be read in different semantics. Functional languages have two notions of what it means to have an actual parameter for a function. There's the ones that act like arguments will be evaluated at the point when they are given as parameters, as actual parameters. So they are evaluated before they are handed over to the function. That is the case in languages like SNL. Then there's this call by name thing, where arguments are passed without evaluation beforehand. They are just passed on by reference, so to say, and are then evaluated for the value whenever there is an actual expression where they are really used and are needed for computing the actual return value of the current expression. There might be branches, for example, in these conditional branching things, where the parameter is not used, and if it turns out that the branch condition evaluates in a way that such a branch is not used, there's no actual benefit from really computing that value apart from burning CPU time, so you can safely discard that thing, and that is the situation where this call by name thing actually really pays off, and only in cases where you really use a parameter within the active path in your program, then you will finally evaluate it at some point. So that is the idea behind these two semantics. Let's have a look at what the architecture of such a thing might look like. So we had, if you remember or recall how the schema started, we had the idea of having a code store where we would put our actual instruction sequence into, which we could and just follow step by step by just evaluating the program counter, incrementing its address, and manipulating its address within the actual semantics of certain instructions if need arises. So this is a thing that comes quite in handy if you have this concept of quasi-linear codes and only seldom deviate from this thing by manipulating control flow. And for MAMA, we try to go in the same direction. We also want to produce sequences of code instructions in that sense, and so we reuse that concept of the code store and the program counter. For the runtime stack, this is a thing which we have met in the schema that came in handy for storing things like local variables and parameters and all that, and also came in handy for temporary or intermediate results that we had when we evaluated expressions. And since we're all about expressions in this functional language, a stack-like structure for keeping data, again, looks like a good idea. So we also take a runtime stack as another component for our virtual machine. This can hold basic values or addresses, pretty similar to what we had in the schema thing. We, again, have a stack pointer to keep track of where we have progressed into the actual stack, and the frame pointer to keep track of where our management data structures for earlier frame instances live in the stack. So, so far, no new things. What we need now also is a heap, and there we now deviate a little bit from what we have seen in the schema. So the MAMA will make heavy use of the heap with a lot of different structures that are put in there, and the differences between those structures this time can arise by the way that certain control structures or data-related instructions are working. So there's already by means of what the machine lets us specify the need for certain different items to put in the stack. In order to do so, we introduce for these heap-based things a tag. So this is always this white box in front of each of the heap elements, which will tell us what the purpose of that particular element of the heap will be. We'll see what are the possibilities for these things. Then there's possibly things like pointers to the code store, which are for our purposes here in this grayish tone. So they can be in a few of those things present. So it's the code pointers. We might keep values in them, the bluish things. So they can be already evaluated things in the memory. And there might be pointers to the heap itself. So there's cross references to other heap structures. Like here, where you point this way, here, where we point to this thing, and so on. So these are the typical things that can happen in heap structures. To be more precise, what kinds of items we can find in the heap is what we have already hinted at, is that there's basic values. Those are flagged with a B thing at the beginning, and they just carry what we consider to be a basic value, which is for our purposes just an integer. So that is one thing that can live in the heap. Then there's the concept of a closure marked with a C. Basically, this is not yet computed expression, or whatever we will generate in order to represent an expression, and what we usually use for that is some pointer to the code, where we find the code that is responsible for evaluating that piece of expression. And then there's another pointer that points to additional information that might be needed in order to compute those expressions. Usually this is some kind of data structure that keeps the values for global variables. Next thing will be functions, again flagged in their own way. And they can be considered to be pretty close to what a closure actually is. So this also has code that is responsible for performing the actual evaluation of the function. There is helper data that you need for evaluation for global functions, for global variables used throughout the function body. But what also comes into play for functions is usually some representation of what has been bound to the parameters of the function. And this is a thing that can be found in this second component that goes to some other structure where we can find that. And since I've talked so much about other structures in there, what else is there? There's kind of a list or a vector in that sense that can keep several things of the same type. So this is flagged as this we thingy. This usually has a size that is given as its second component. And then there is the cells of the vector that can be obtained by indexing. So you can give a vector an integer, and this will return the content of the ith cell. That is, and those can then again point to some other heap structure, like basic values, closures, or functions, depending on whatever is associated with that cell. So these are the things that you typically can find on the heap, and they make heavy use of referring to each other in that sense. So for example, this global variable values thing that you see over here usually refers to a vector where you store all the things that are associated with the global variables. So they use each other. What you then use in order to create things in the heap usually is an instruction new. So that's this thing over here that now takes two parameters, tags and args, that creates such an object depending on whatever the tag says in the heap, and then returns a reference to that. We will see how that works a little bit later when we start adding new things to the heap in our code generation schemes. Then, what else is there? As you might recall, last time for the SEMA, we have started with some kind of generic code generation, which soon was extended to code generation functions that would carry with them the context in which they are used, like think of the expression evaluation, where you had need for left-hand side, right-hand side code generation schemes. And this time around, we're going to say beforehand that there's three different modes of code generation for expressions for the SEMA. So there's the kind of straightforward one, which is this code V for an expression. This is responsible for creating code that actually computes a value, so evaluates an expression, stores the value in the heap, maybe with help of one of these value heap objects, and returns a reference to that on top of the stack. The other thing that we see here is code B, which computes the value of E and returns itself on top of the stack. This is pretty close to what we have seen for the right-hand side values of SEMA expressions. But as the B already indicates, this is a thing that, of course, only works for basic types. So there is cases where expressions evaluate to something different. For those, we don't have any choice than just keeping to code V. So code B evaluates on the stack itself. Then there's code C, which is the third mode that we have for code generation, which doesn't actually really evaluate the E, but stores a closure of E on the heap. So stores some object that can be used in order to compute E later on, and returns a reference to such a closure on the top. If you get them in this place here, you might be a little bit confused for now, but as we progress on to later slides, I guess you'll see where the use for these three things actually really is. So let's have maybe we start with focusing on those two in the beginning and see where we end up, and maybe at some point we even see a hint where the closure could be used later on. So, as we had it last time, simple expressions usually offer a good way to start coming into the mood of how code generation actually really works for a new language. So, for simple expressions, what can be said here? So, they can usually consist of constants. This is quite similar as we had before. So the the code generation for constant B just consists in a load constant of said thing. So this is exactly the same as we had it for SEMA. Then there's the code generation in terms of basic values for a unary operator, and this again is similar to what we have seen before. This is the code generation function for the child expression, followed by the application of the operator with its own instruction. That is another thing that we can copy from the SEMA. And then there is this binary expression, where we first of all evaluate the left-hand side of the operator, then the right-hand side, and then in the end call the operator in postfix style. So far, this looks remarkably similar to what we have had for the SEMA, with one crucial difference. I'm sure you all have spotted it already. So there's a thing here. So for our purposes, we have added a new parameter to the code generation, function. This is usually a number. And what might SD be the abbreviation for? This is the stack distance, and this is due to keeping track of the amount of cells that we have so far used during the evaluation of sub expressions, and that we are not yet eager to release. So this gives us an idea of how far we are in the current stack, and how far we are in that sense away from the frame pointer at some point, I say. Let's not question that for now too much. Let's just be said that one crucial difference between the SEMA and the MAMA will be that the frame pointer won't be that a reliable way of addressing the locals as it had been in the SEMA, and we have to find our way to the locals manually in that case, and that is why we count the amount of cells that we use during evaluation of expressions, so that we can compute the value of the locals by this number that we have kept track of together with the top of the stack pointer SP. Okay, since those are pretty similar to the ones that we had on SEMA, let's have a look at the conditional expression, which by itself doesn't add too much that we don't know so far already. So let's just do it. There's the basic code generation for if then else. And well, as you can imagine, what it does is, as it had been done for CIMA, it consists in a value computed for the expression. This goes here first. This is a thing that is immediately used for jumping on that value. So the jump C is following this, which then jumps over whatever has been was being generated for the then part to the else part. So let's this jump to A. The default case falls through, executes the true branch with this code B for E1, and a solid jump to the end of everything with this B. And the else part just goes here. So that's not so complicated in that sense, so we can treat it already together with the simple expressions. Row, we have already some idea of what that does. This is again the address environment for our expressions. It might be filled a little bit differently than in the CIMA, but so far we use it in a similar way for creating accesses to variables. This extra argument, SD, is being the stack distance. It simulates the movement of the stack pointer. So right here, where we have actually kept the value of an expression on the push down for later use with the operator here, we had to generate the second operand in the next stack cell. Thus, we would increase the number of used stack cells. So that is why we incremented the stack difference for the evaluation of the second operand. And then the operator would consume both of these things again, and keeping us with the same stack distance that we have started with. So this stack distance thing just counts the number of cells that we add on top of the stack, and that is, I think, the thing. So then, with the operations that we have mentioned, this is just the same way as it had been for the CIMA. So this has been the simple expressions. But what to do for the ones that we have not seen here? So there's some kind of generic way of coming up with code generations for arbitrary expressions that have not been specialized over here, and this would be the scheme from here, where we would trigger the code generation for computations of expression values in the heap with this code V of E. So this will trigger the computation that gives us a result in the heap, followed by get basic, which will then go to the memory cell referred to from the top of the stack, obtain the value stored there, and put it on the stack. So this retrieves a value from the heap to the stack. And so with that, we can kind of bridge our way from the basic code generation to the value object code generation. For that, we specify the semantics in the following way. So we have the new get basic instruction. It emanates from situations where you have pointers on top of the push down and point to some basic value. And in case that this is actually a basic value, you will transfer that to the top of the stack. In every other case, we would bail out with an error message, but usually the code generation schemes that we use will not lead to such a situation. So this should not really occur in correctly implemented code that comes from correctly implemented code generation schemes, but yeah, in case you hit arbitrarily written machine code, this might come in handy. So, how does the code generation for value objects look like? Well, let's have a look at those. You might be tempted to generate value objects for constants. Well, they go the other direction. They temporarily create the constant on the pushdown and then move them to the heap with this nkBasic, which will then just create a basic type object in the heap out of whatever it finds on top of the pushdown and returns a reference to that. So this is kind of when we before had the the bridge from the heap to the stack. This is bridging into the other way, from the stack to the heap. Same goes for the value object code generation for unary operators. This is just the same code that we had for the code B version, just with an appended make basic. And same, you could say, for the binary operator, and then in the end, again, make basic. So they are just literally doing the base code, basic value code generation, and then followed by make basic. Well, that's just making use of what we already have. The a little bit of different approach is for the value object code generation for the conditional branching expression, because this now, instead of generating basic code, will now generate value object code for E1 and E2 while already evaluating the condition with the basic code. So, and since this is consumed anyway, this won't be necessary to transfer to the heap. So instead, we can just let E1 and E2 be evaluated on the heap. Okay, so this is not particularly smart. This is just the addition of a make basic in the end of each of the so far already known schemes. So what does this make basic do? I've already told you basically what it does. So there's a basic value on top of the pushdown. So what it will create is basic type value object in the heap, and it will return a reference to that. And in terms of semantics of the virtual machine, this is now making use of this new thing that we have announced to be using before already. So this is this new with a tag B and the value that is on top of the stack. Now, let's move on to actually accessing variables in the whole thing. So this is where the fun starts. This has already been seen in a similar way in the SEMA part. This is all, there it also was a little bit more exciting than just plain constant expressions. So for accessing variables, we have the concept of locals and globals. What is a local and what is a global in the context of a functional program? So let's have a look at an example. So there's a function f over here with let expression let C be 5 in a function definition, mapping from A to an expression where B is the square of an A within B plus C. And this then is used as a function f in the expression down there. So, talking of this part over here, where we define the f, we have a parameter, and this is used in the body of the function. So this is this thing over here. So for our purposes of generating code, we consider this A to be kind of a local variable in the function f, whereas there's other things being used within f. So there's, for example, this C thing. For C, we don't have any binding within the function itself. So this is, in that sense, unbound locally for this F thing, and is only bound by a surrounding let expression, this one over here. And if that is the case, if we have something that is locally unbound, then this is considered to be a global variable. Okay, so these are the two things that we disambiguate between. So the question is now, when is the what does it mean to have this C being mentioned in here? And there are several ways of coming from the mentioning of some variable name to its value. Particularly interesting is the timing when we determine when the value is actually really bound to that thing. And for us, we consider this C to be bound at the time of constructing the function. So as soon as we start assembling everything that we need here, the C is the value for C is fixed statically to this 5 thing, and later only looked up. So it's never evaluated again with whatever C might evaluate to in the context of where the thing is executed, for example. So we might wonder how we can actually do this in terms of support that from our runtime environment. And for that, we introduce the concept of the global vector. So whenever we construct a new function, we can access the global variables from this function. There's analysis that give us the unbound functions, the unbound names in the body of the function, and those we consider to be global variables for which we need to provide values in the global vector. And so we establish a new vector element in the heap, which we fill with the current values of the, or well, with which we bind to the global variables. I on purpose don't want to say we store the values in there, because we in call by name we might still want to store not actual values but instructions of how to compute these values in there. And we keep this vector bound to this function object that we create there, and handed around together with a function object until we reach a point where the function object is then evaluated itself, and there the execution of the parameter evaluations might happen at some point. So this is what the global vector is all about. So we have that already. In order to then do an evaluation of an expression, we need to at some point address global variables. And since for current function bodies, we usually are interested in evaluating those with respect to the global values at the point of the point in time where the function has been created. We have to then make use of the global vector, and in order to do so, we can rely on one thing, namely that there is a newly introduced register GP, which is the global pointer, which is for each execution of a method body usually set to point to the right global vector. So this is the connection to where to the point where the function had been created, and the global vector had been stored within the function. As soon as you stop executing the function, you take the global vector out of its anchor in the function representation and let the global point, the global pointer point to this heap object. In contrast, the local variables, remember, those were the ones that were obtained from actual parameters that were given at the point of where the function had been called. They usually can still be found on the stack itself. So for the address environment, we have a similar structure as we had before. The row points to a marker, either local or global, depending on where we have to resolve the variables, together with a particular index from Z. So this is our address environment. How to address local variables? They are pretty similar as before, administered on the stack within the frame of the current function. So let's have a look at what usually is considered to be a call of some function. This would be an expression that looks like this, where the first e prime somehow gives a function object on the heap, and e0 to em-1 are considered to be the first m arguments to the function. What you might as well consider at this place here already is that in this world where we're moving here, we are not really requiring anymore that the number of function arguments that we find on the stack are in any direct connection to the number of arguments that appear in some kind of function. There are several cases that can happen. Of course, there can be the case where we have exactly as many arguments on the stack and as the function expects, then everything is the same way as we have had before. But there might also be situations where f receives less than the number of arguments that it expects. This is called undersupply. And there might also be situations where f receives more than the arguments that it expects to receive. This is the oversupply case. So these are two cases that are not forbidden, but are elements of what can happen to the in functional programming, and we're going to see how we react to these situations. So with that in mind, we can have a look at how we might like to organize our stack. So there's the idea of having a frame pointer, of course, and then there's the way that you manage the parameter passing together with the generation of the actual function object. And what you usually do without any doubt is that the topmost cell will end up being the function object to execute. So this usually refers to a function object corresponding to the e'. So I think this is without any doubt the case. The question is now how to organize the parameter passing of the arguments e0 to em-1. And you could, for example, arrange them in the way that you see over here, starting with the first parameter from here, ending with the last parameter here. And if you do so, you can quite easily address the arguments relative to the frame pointer, which looks quite nice. You should also keep in mind that if you do that, the local variables of e'. It's a little bit difficult to address them relative to the frame pointer, depending on the number of parameters that have been given to the function. The other thing is that in case of oversupply of the function, this is a little bit difficult to handle, since in case that the we have with oversupply too many parameters on top of the stack, we would have additional ones in between there, which would not be particularly well suited for the execution of the function itself now, because they are in that sense in the way and would have to be extracted from their position right now and placed beyond everything else for later usage to be applied to function objects that come later. And this is quite not so nice, because they would have to be moved somewhere down on the pushdown. So this is a thing that we rather would not like to have. The alternative is a similar thing that we have done in the CIMA. We would start the argument provision from the last actual parameter over here and work our way up there to actually then reach this e0. This would be this would enable us to always consider the region between the function itself and as many parameters as it uses to be just one block in that sense. So this is what we would like to do. This is then creating a few problems whenever the arguments of a function need to be addressed, since the number of parameters that are given to a function are not known at compile time of the function body anymore, since there can be this under provisioning and overfilling with parameters. So it's not possible to directly address these variables A0 or parameters A0 and A1 anymore with a static distance to FP. And this is, well, the actual cause why we now need this new parameter stack distance, SD, that helps us out for that situation, because we actually want to organize the parameters beneath the actual local variables. So local variables and arguments now will be addressed relative to the stack pointer SP. And this is a little bit difficult because, as we have seen, the stack pointer grows and shrinks during the execution of a program. So there might be intermediate values which we might keep on the stack. They constitute to this area over here, which is in between the start of the parameters and the top of the stack. So this is even a thing that changes throughout the progress in your current expression evaluation. So we need to make up for that. And the idea is to actually keep track of the changes that that happen there and keep them in parameter that we call SD and give to the code generation function in order to keep track of how large this part now actually is, so that we can always find our way from the actual stack pointer to the intended top of the stack that we call SP0. This is not an actual register, but it's a virtual register that we can whose value we can compute from the actual stack pointer together with the value of SD. So the formal parameters, apart from that, usually receive non-positive relative addresses starting from this SP. So from there to there, we can reach our formal parameters. So the locals in that sense, so parameter I is usually obtainable in the address environment as marker for local variable with its negative index. So this is usually a way that the formal parameters can be found. And the value of the address of such a thing now needs to be computed, not just as a pure index to I, but as a thing that is a constant index to this virtual top of the stack, SP0. And the value of the SP0 we have to come up with. As we see, it's always found with a particular distance to the top of the stack, and this we can make use of and replace this virtual top of the stack with this stack pointer minus the stack distance. This will then give us the way of the actual intended top of the stack, and from there we can address the parameters with the index quite straightforward. Apart from that, there's local variables that stem from let bindings, and those are just successively pushed to onto the stack while incrementing the stack distance, of course, in order to account for the amount of space that we allocate on top of the stack. So this will all contribute to the addressing on the stack. So let's have this example here, which is now I think already the full-fledged example of everything that can happen there. So there is the the local variables that come from the parameters over here, they are addressed with respect to this virtual top of the stack SP0 with negative indices. And then there's potentially let bindings that occur during the evaluation of the body of the function expression. And they will then start being added on top of this SP0, and they will be addressed also just directly with the index in which they occur. Always, of course, relative to the virtual top of the stack, which we obtain by merging the stack distance into the stack pointer, providing us with the correct entry point into the stack for addressing. Yeah, so in order to address the locally bound let expression variables yi, we then index in the positive direction from this SP0, which we can then boil down to this SP minus SD plus I. So much for those. In the call by name semantics of the code generation, we usually also have a last step to go before we can actually really access the value of an address, the value of a variable. Remember, we had this concept in CPN where the variables would be given to parameters of a function by reference and not by by actual value, so there might still be the need for actual evaluation of the function. So whenever we then really access such a variable, we need to make sure that it is really evaluated, and that is what we get by this eval that is placed after the code for actually accessing the variable itself. In case of this CBM, we check whether this value has already been computed. If not, we would trigger the evaluation. And if it is already, we can just obtain the result from the heap. But more of that we will see later on in the topics here. For now, it's just that we put an eval in there. There's also this other notion of code generation, CPV, where we already have the computed parameters in the reference, and there we can just remove the eval and just plainly obtain the variable with a get var. So what is this get var now? This is now a thing that needs a little bit of work by the runtime machine and finally ends up with creating either of those two instructions. The other things need to be evaluated from the runtime machine. So what happens in the runtime machine is that the name for the variable is actually looked up in the address environment, and we extract tag and index from that. So we can work with T now, and depending on whether the tag matches with the thing being a local variable, we will then emit push local. If the tag matches a G, it will be push global, and then we're done. In both cases, we also work with the index I, but in one case, we have to scale it in order to in order to get the addressing scheme right. And I think I said it wrongly a few seconds ago, so this is a thing that is not considered to be done by the runtime environment. The code in black here is considered to be part of the code generation scheme. So this is code that is evaluated during compile time, not during runtime. Brain fart from my part. So yeah, the row thing is a thing that we only have during compile time, of course. And also we're talking about compile time code generation schemes. So yeah, sorry, compile time code. In terms of what the runtime environment has to do, this is just interpretation of this and this instruction. So let's have a look at what the push log do, does, which is therefore the local variables. So this is usually given parameter n. And what it does is it takes n as an index from the current value of the stack pointer. So this n is interpreted as a stack distance thing, or a distance on the stack. And the cell that has the distance of n to the current top of the stack, in our world here, points to a particular heap value. And after execution of this push log n, we have duplicated this this pointer, put it on top of the pushdown, having it point to the same heap element that has been pointed to before. So this pulls some reference to the heap out from somewhere beyond to the top of the pushdown. And this, well, in that sense, just retrieves a particular value from the insides of the stack. So that is pretty easily implemented. Yeah, so this is just an argument on whether this is actually correct, what we do. So this consists of the value of the stack pointer and the stack distance before the execution of an instruction, and before the execution of the actual push local instruction, and this is the computation of the address which is loaded from SA, and this is gotten by the stack pointer minus stack distance minus I, which we have given to the push local over here, which then will, well, the stack distance minus the SP is usually considered to be the SP plus I, which is exactly what we desired to actually have. So those two together, the push log with the stack distance minus the index of the variable, together with the addressing with respect to the top of the stack, will actually then get us the address we desire. The push global was the other thing that we had generated. So this part over here, push glob I for a global variable. And remember, the globals were the ones that were not clear how to resolve during a compilation of just the function body, because they would refer to the something found outside of the scope of the function itself, and had to be given to the function with the global vector. So this is now the push global, which is there to access the ith global variable. And as we said, we have introduced this new register GP, And the convention here is that we usually keep a vector of globals found throughout the current function body evaluation here referred to from GP, and this will at that distance I from the start of the vector at position I then refer to some memory cell, and the push glob, what it will do is it will look up in this global vector the ith cell and copy the reference found in there to the top of the push down, so that this now points to this thing. And in terms of semantics of the runtime, this is quite an easy thing. So stack pointer is incremented and filled with whatever the global pointer pointed to. Let's have an example of how such addressing can really work. So the expression in question is just the basic value. It's just a binary expression of two variables, and as an address environment we find the B being a local variable, and particularly the one at position 1, and C being a global variable at position 0, and the stack distance right now being 1. So what we're interested in is the value object cogeneration for this E thing with row and, well, the current stack distance being 1. So let's have a look at how to do that. This E plus C goes to the, first of all, we want the value object cogeneration for this expression, and value code object representation cogeneration is for an addition, just the code basic for the addition together with the make basic, which then packs the value and puts it on the heap. So this will consist in make basic, which is the packing instruction, and whatever we generate for the basic cogeneration for B plus C. Basic cogeneration for B plus C usually consists of the add and the two operands. So there's two operands involved, which are these two guys. For the operation involved, for the operands involved in that, we then see that, well, this is now variables for which we need the basic value, since it's basic code generation. So we put get basic in there and then can make use of the code V again. And code V for B and C will consist of, well, just the eval in case of this has not been yet fully evaluated, together with the get var, so these two fellows over here. Get var itself is a macro that we have to evaluate. This then forks between whether we have global or local values, and, well, let's have a look. In our case, the B thing needs to trigger the L version, so this will go to push local, and what it needs to push is the current stack distance minus the index mentioned there, and the index there is 1, so this will be push local 0, and the eval we take over from before, and then there is the get var of C, which is a global, so this goes to the other variant out there, which is the push global, which directly gets the index as a parameter, so it's push global of again 0 and eval, and the rest is just copied from over there. And yeah, so with that you see the the code that is generated together with an illustration of how the stack distance value evolves throughout execution of this code thing. Okay? Good. So, with that, we can even have a look at how let expressions now can be interpreted. So, what we have so far is basic expressions. We have if then else, we have variable accesses. Let's start with binding a few variables to expressions with these let expressions. So this is talking about this particular pattern of code that you might encounter. So it introduces a few names step by step for expressions E1 to EN with finally E0 giving the return value of this expression. So what is this fellow here supposed to give us? Well, first of all, there is these let bound variable names that are introduced with this expression. So what we should somehow keep in mind is that we need some representation for those in memory. So we should allocate space for that, particularly also for referring to these variables, and therefore we need some space on the stack. And they need to be introduced. Then there is different cases, particularly there's CBV and CBN, and CBV just directly evaluates each expression bound to one of the Y's. So in the end, we'll end up with a lot of references to basic values. And CBN instead will not immediately touch the expressions themselves, but will bind instruction sequences that perform the actual evaluation to those names for later evaluation at the points when the variables are really used. So this is kind of delay of the actual eval function from the point in time where you bind the variables to the point in time where you use them. So that is the concept behind this eval thing. And in the end, this expression needs to evaluate the expression E0 and return the value that is produced by that. So you might also realize that for the definition that we have here, we are not talking about the one that has the rec modifier between let and the bindings. So this is just the non-recursive case. So yj can only depend on y1 to yj minus 1. So for CBN, what we get is, so just remember, E is corresponding to Y1, is assigned, is bound to E1, and so on. For the value object code generation, we get, for CBN, we need to generate not actual values, but we need to generate code that produces values. So here's the first point where we are confronted with not code V and code B, but instead with our entry point into code C things. So code C we have introduced in the very beginning. We have not defined how it is actually working, but we said that its purpose would be to provide references to objects that can be evaluated for the value associated with the expression that it is parameterized with. So that's how we use that. So we generate code C for E1, that is this fellow here, and use special purpose row here, which is row 0, and we continue to generate a lot of these code C codes. So we create a lot of closures in that sense for computing the values of all the expressions which are bound to some value here. So from E1 to EN we generate code C. Each of those things will leave a reference to closure on the stack. So since all of them at some point will be needed for executing the final E0 evaluation, what we usually also do then is that we increment the stack distance by whatever many cells have been used before, which is usually the current index of the bound expression minus 1. So this is what you have to keep in mind for that. And then with evaluating E0, we finally switch over to back to the value code generation for E0 with an address environment that has all the bindings for the expressions that we have generated closures for beforehand. The address environment then, this P0 to PN, develops itself from its predecessor. So P0 starts with the row 0 starts with the row given to the value object code generation from before, and each increment of the of this row will then be computed by the row earlier on, which gets an additional mapping from let bound variable mapped to the tuple local variable, and stack distance plus j. So the position of the local that is associated with the yj in that setting. So so this is the place on the pushdown that we have reserved for this yj. Okay. In case of call by value, we will not need to keep the value uncomputed so far. Instead, we can directly compute the resulting value of the expression. So this code C will be replaced by code V for each of these code C things. So there, in these situations, no closures will arise. Okay, let's have a look at an example for that. So, an example expression, we take this one here. This has two let bindings. So there's a let binding of A is 19. In another let binding, B is A square, and then finally there's A plus B. the initial values for the adverse environment we find over here are given as the adverse environment is empty and the stack distance is zero. So how does that work now? Well, let's have a look. So there is the scheme from over here, which we can use for these nested let expressions. In CBN, which we will assume to be the one that is most interesting for us, since it is a little bit different from what the schema does, will consist in calling the C codes for each of the expressions, and then in the end only do the evaluation. So for that, we need to do the following things. So there is the A bound to 19. So 19 is the first expression for which we have to call the code thingy, which will be, well, just load C, or maybe start even from the back for this one. So for the whole thing, we need to slide all the temporarily introduced bindings from the stack again. So this is this slide 2. Then there is the value code generation for E0, which is the value object thing for this one here is the basic value code generation followed by a make basic. So this is this one. The expression in a basic code generation form will consist of an add and its two parameters, which are the second one is a B, which is a local variable. So we will do a push lock with the value we're going to be given by the row 1. Row 1 is will consist of the, or even row 2 it will even be, will consist of the mapping of B to, what is it, I think 1 probably. Stack pointer plus, yeah, so to 1, so this is push local 1, and then get basic in order to obtain the value from memory. Then the first parameter is this A thing, which comes from push local and get basic, and those two will be added then. Okay. Then there is the code C's for, oh, it's CBV. Oh, yeah. This will directly have the values already already prepared on the push down, so there is for those we can then directly just evaluate whenever we have the expressions there. So that's why there's a direct load C and a make basic here for the value for A, which is then used as the value for A, and then used inside the computation for the value for B. So there's a push log 0 and get basic, and push log 1 get basic with multiply, which will generate the code for B. This has to be packed onto the heap with this make basic for later use then, and then we run into this evaluation of the thing with a push log 1 and push log 1. Both of the variables will result in a push log 1 since there is this growing stack distance, so each of them will actually really point to different places in the stack, but yeah, anyway. With that, we generate this example here. So the final thing that we have not yet talked about is this slide K, which is used at the end of the let binding. This was this one here, which deallocates all local variables, but this works pretty similar to the thing that we have seen in the SEMA already, where the resulting value had to be transported to the bottom of the memory region that we used for a parameter passing, and yeah, we already have this slide K implementation for that. So this emanates from the case where the top of the pushdown has some valuable information, but we want to get rid of the K number of cells beyond that. So slide K will just do that. It will remove these things and transfer the value from top of the stack to there. And this is pretty straightforward to implement in the runtime. So with that, we could now start with how to do function definitions, but I think 4 minutes will not suffice to do this thing in a meaningful way. So I would say let's keep it to just let expressions and start next time freshly with function definitions. So I would say let's keep it with that and stop here.